The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. Salute a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh. Call 919-917-7729 for more information. You can also visit www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out. And my first guest for the first time hosting Salute a Veteran Every Day is Bill Stewart.
Hello.
Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Bill and I go back to second grade. And
long way, long time ago.
Oh, yeah. We met for coffee this morning, and I knew he was a vet, but it didn't dawn on me to invite him to be on the program until somehow we got started talking about Desert One, the attempt to rescue the Iranian hostages back in 1990. Excuse me, 80. You correct me.
Yeah.
you know for sure. So I asked Bill to come on. He has a very interesting background, and to make sure we covered everything, I asked him to just list all of his assignments, where they were, and then we'll go back and talk about them individually. Otherwise, we might get down some bunny trails and leave some out. That would never happen, would it, Bill?
Oh, no. Not at all.
So, first of all, a little about you. You're from Raleigh, right?
Well, I was born in Pennsylvania. I was 4 years old when we moved here.
Okay.
So, from that point until I went into the military, this was home.
Mm-hmm. What age did you go into the military?
I went into the military at 18.
Let's go ahead and do that list, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about each of them. Because I found that civilians often ask me, well, when they found out I was in the military, well, where did you serve? That's the first thing they want to know. Where did you serve? So, and then sometimes when I get to Las Vegas, which was my second assignment, that'll start a bunny trail, you know.
Right.
Sort of quickly, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I started my career actually in the Army back in January of 68. Of course, went to boot camp and to, after boot camp, technical school. And then after technical school, I went to jump school, so I was airborne.
So boot camp, Fort Bragg, tech school, and jump school, Fort Benning, Georgia.
Right.
Then back to Fort Bragg, it looks like.
Yeah, back to Fort Bragg with the 82nd Airborne Division. From there, I was sent to Mainz, Germany with the 8th Army as, I was a PLL clerk, which is a...
Petroleum clerk.
Yeah, petroleum. My primary MOS was...
Military Occupational Specialty.
Yep. Okay, true.
I told Bill I was going
to
hold him.
I'm trying to...
hold him down on the acronym. Let's just go the list of where, and then we'll come back
okay.
for the details.
Yeah, that was... I was in Mainz, Germany with the 8th Army. It was an infantry unit. And then from there, I went to the 101st Airborne Division in Vietnam. I was stationed up north by close to the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone, in a place called Phu Bai or Camp Eagle, which was just a short distance from where we were.
And we're thankful to have you back.
I'm definitely thankful. After leaving Vietnam, then, I got out.
Let's talk years here. That was...
Okay. That was 1970 when I actually got out on Halloween, which was trick or treat, you know.
Spooky.
And then I went into the National Guard doing primarily what I was supposed to be doing, which was being a helicopter maintenance person.
Okay.
And that's where I really got the want. I mean, when I was in Vietnam, I flew. Of course, and I was a door gunner, so I just wanted to keep that up, and I did. So from there...
What caliber machine gun?
60s in the Army.
60s, uh-huh.
Yeah, and then from there, I got kind of sidetracked and decided, well, with my brother Steve, he was in the Navy. He had joined the Navy after I joined the Army, and then he had talked me into coming into the Navy, get brother duty, and of course, I went through all the OSVET, which is other service veteran that I had to go through a school to learn about the Navy.
Just to turn you from a Army green to Navy blue.
Navy blue,
right?
That's okay. It. And then I had to go to my course, another technical school for aviation electronics. And then from there, I went to the squadron where he was stationed. I got there in October, and lo and behold, he got out in November.
Wow. So they kept you with your brother, huh?
Well, for 1 month. That was very interesting, you know, the fact that, you know, he got out and I was had just gotten there, so.
Mm-hmm. But you got your wish. You got to be with your brother.
Yeah, I got to be with my brother in the Navy, and then he got out, so.
That didn't promise you a lifetime.
No. Come to find out, I really enjoyed it, and I ended up sticking around in the military for 32 years total, so.
Awesome. And that was around 77?
Yes, that was. October, November 77, and then I went from into what they call helicopter mine countermeasures as an air crewman, and we would do mine sweeping from helicopters. And of course, we did it on the RH-53 at the time, which at the time was the largest helicopter that the United States has, and you had to be very technically oriented to be able to fly as a crewman on there because you had a lot of gear that you had to keep track of. And I
now let's keep us posted on the dates. That was
well, I pretty much did my whole career in helicopter mine countermeasures as you go down through. So I started off in HM-12, which gave me my basic understanding for what I was going to be doing in the squadron.
Mm-hmm.
From there, after I finished up the schools and everything, I got to be what they call a plank owner. And so when HM-16, Helicopter Mine Countermeasure Squadron 16, got commissioned, I was one of the individuals that, you know,
one
commissioned the squadron.
One of the original members.
Members, yes.
You know, you're actually an owner of the squadron, so to speak.
Yes, so to
and
speak.
And that's recognized.
Yep.
Now we go, let's keep this brief, is the attempted rescue of the Iranian hostages in 1979.
That started in just prior to Thanksgiving in November of 1979.
Mm-hmm.
We initially went to Hereford, North Carolina, and began our training there. And it was a joint, what they call a blue-green exercise, blue being Navy, green being Marine Corps, because the Navy and the Marine Corps are they're owned by the Navy. So we started our training there. Went to from there we went out to Yuma, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And we finished the training out there, I trained with them up until the fact where I had to be medevaced out because of injuries to my eyes.
Okay, we'll come back to that. But you were part of getting trained up ready to go in with that
Correct.
Very dangerous mission. Okay, what'd you do after that?
Well, when we finally got through with that mission, then of course I was back to the squadron and doing my main job at the time was I was in charge of scheduling air crew individuals that fly the helicopter the mission, the air crew being the enlisted portion of the squadron, flights and training and
where was that?
That was in Norfolk.
Norfolk.
My whole career spanned in Norfolk all but 2 years.
Wow.
In the Navy.
Did you like that?
Yeah, I really I enjoyed it because I don't think I would have ended up doing 32 years in the military had I not enjoyed it.
And then where did you go after that?
Well, I stayed in Norfolk, and I went to what they call the shore activity. There's sea duty and there's shore duty.
Mm-hmm.
And that HM-12 was – I went back to HM-12 as an instructor.
HM-12 is the
– Helicopter Mine Countermeasures. Yeah, it's what they call the RAG or the training squadron.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and I was an instructor for the air crew, and I would teach what they call plane captain, which is basically doing inspections on the aircraft prior to every flight.
Mm-hmm.
That and then also minesweeping.
Minesweeping. I want to hear more about that, too.
Okay.
Okay, so where'd you go next?
After that, I finished. I stayed in the squadron, but I went from the shore side to the sea side, which meant that I was on sea duty and I could deploy. And I did what they called VOD, which is vertical onboard delivery, to ships that were underway. So it was underway ship support.
Now, this Air Force guy, as a young captain, spent some time on the Kitty Hawk and watched them do those resupplies.
Yep.
Very dangerous looking.
It can be, you know,
yeah.
But, you know, once you
Let's
start
see.
Getting used to the flying, it becomes almost second nature,
yeah.
You know, but you still have to be aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did go down you know, once in Vietnam, or twice in Vietnam, and then once in when I was in HM-16 for maintenance. Well, actually shot down once. A pilot backed into a steel tower once. Mm-hmm. And then we had a co-pilot that didn't shut his window, and it got sucked out of the aircraft and went up into the rotor head.
Oh my gosh.
So we had to make an immediate landing because of that.
So his whole body was sucked out?
No, he wasn't, but his window, the frame and everything just got pulled out and went right up into the rotor head.
Thanks for clarifying this.
Sorry.
I was visualizing too many movies.
Poof.
Yeah. But still, that could have been catastrophic.
It could, very much so. They had to, actually, we were very fortunate that we had a tremendous, huge parking lot to land in, mm-hmm. because it was a TV production place, I believe it was GE, in Portsmouth, Virginia, and they had just, their parking lot had just emptied. We were able to put it down there, and of course they had to come out, and we had trashed or torn up a couple of the rotor blades, had to change the rotor blades out and everything before they could fly the helicopter back out of there and back home.
Mm-hmm. And then, where are we here?
Let's see. Then I went back to, actually, it's kind of funny because in 1985, I got picked up. But in 1985, I got picked up by the Army again to go back to Warrant Officer Flight School.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Fort Rucker, and what they didn't pay attention to was when I had sent my original flight physical in that I had an injury to my ankle before I could even get into the flight portion of the instruction. They decided to do a physical on me, and when they checked my ankle, they said the ankle was, there was too big of an opening in the joint, so it could cause a insecurity and in operation of the tail rotor flight control. So they didn't want me flying. So I went back to the Navy.
Back to the Navy. So you went Army, Navy, Army, Navy.
Absolutely.
I always wanted
to be the guy in the front, you know.
Just like Bill's an unusual guy, has an unusual career path, very unusual.
Yep.
Now tell me about when you went on to a little cheat sheet here to follow along, but I've lost my place. Yeah, here and then also when you
is
went
that,
to...
Is that HC-2 where it's a helicopter combat squadron. Combat squadron. Yeah. That was, I was the...
Is that at Norfolk?
Yes, everything's been at Norfolk as far as the Navy goes up until my last 2 years in the Navy.
Let's cover those real quickly.
Okay. From there, from HC-2, I went to I got commissioned and to a chief warrant officer.
And that was Mustang University?
Yeah, Mustang University is what they call where they send you to get your officer training out of the way.
And
because if you've had more than 4 years of active service as an enlisted, you're automatically become what they call a Mustang.
Okay, tell our listeners, I was going to say, what a Mustang is.
Yeah, a Mustang is just an officer that has been in, like I said, 4 years or longer when he gets originally commissioned.
Commissioned, uh-huh. And you get a little extra pay for that, too.
Not really. you know, I got commissioned, so yeah.
Didn't prior enlisted get extra pay for so long? No.
Well, yeah, every 2 years. I mean, you know, it's just the same. You know, every 2 years you get a increase in your base pay.
Okay.
And then from there I went,
back. Let's not pass that up too quick. So you became an officer, a warrant officer.
Yes.
At the Mustang University. How was that to go through?
Oh, that was not difficult. It was just basically 2 months worth of, or maybe 3 months worth of just training. They send you back through what they call first off fork and knife school, which is learn the manners, become an officer, a gentleman. So, you know, math, English, so on and so forth to make sure that, you know, because you're going to be doing a lot of writing as an officer. So they had to make sure that I was up to snuff on that. And then after that, the second portion of it was where I had to go through maintenance officer school. So because I was going to become a maintenance material control officer. And then eventually I moved up to an assistant maintenance officer, which is not a normal career path for a warrant officer.
We'd call this in the Air Force flying a desk.
Yes.
And just to continue your list here, then you retired.
Well, actually, I went from HM to VP, mm-hmm. which is fixed wing. It's a patrol squadron. They're the guys that go out and do with the sonobuoys and look for submarines. Also, the guys that are trying to bring drugs into the country
mm-hmm.
on the fast boats.
So you're doing a dangerous job. Dangerous mission there.
Well, my mission was just to make sure that the parts were there for the airplanes to fly.
I see. But that squadron's mission was
very
important to interdiction of drugs, right?
Yes.
And then let's retire you real quick and then back up and talk in depth about some of these other things.
Okay. Well, I retired in May of 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me my my 32 years military, of which I served 6 years as a commissioned officer. The rest of the time was enlisted.
Mm-hmm. It's popular now to say thank you for your service, and so thank you for your service, Bill.
Thank you very much. I'm thanking you for yours, too,
well,
Frank.
I tell people it was a ball.
Definitely.
With a few exceptions, of course. But it's a great career. Both of us being from Raleigh, I never thought of going in the military. Did you?
Right there towards the end. Well, I was a high school dropout,
mm-hmm.
and that was my main purpose once I dropped was to go into the military. So my dad was in, but it's not that that had anything to do with me going into the military. It's just that, you know, several of my friends had, and it just, to me, it was a good thing for me for the discipline of my life.
Mm-hmm. Did you say you matured a little later on?
Oh, a ton. I matured a whole bunch.
But Bill's a great guy, and we were talking again over coffee about how, you know, everybody's not ready for school. We weren't shining examples.
True.
But we did pretty well overall. Let's go back to sub hunting. Put us in the seat of a helicopter that's hunting subs.
Well, I didn't hunt subs in the helicopters. What I did was look for mines.
Or mines.
When the ships go over to the Straits of Hormuz, which takes them up into the Persian Gulf, we have to, you know, a lot of times they've said they've laid mines. So you think of the moored mine, most people do when you talk about mining the oceans. We cut them. Those mm-hmm. are the moored mines. They float up to the surface, and then, of course, we shoot them out of the water with 50 mm-hmm. caliber machine guns.
That's fun.
And then, so that's what we would have to do you have to remember that the one of the main missions of the U.S. Navy is to keep the sea lanes open
mm-hmm.
so that shipping, not only our military ships, but civilian ships can get into and out of ports without being destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Would it be overstating things to say there would be a lot of piracy and shenanigans going on around the world without the Navy keeping eye?
Well, definitely without the Navy keeping eye. I know that the Navy's out there trying to take out some of the pirates. Our big mission was against Iran trying mm-hmm. to destroy the Navy ships and such. So we have to go in and look for these mines, either using mechanical gear or using technical gear. Mm-hmm. We'd pull a sled, you know, 6,000, 7,000 pound sled through the water, which did influence type mines. Mm-hmm. And then if it was a...
Caused them to blow up?
Caused them to blow up,
yeah, mm-hmm.
correct. Yeah, they sit on the bottom and they do ship counts and they, as you're going through, mm-hmm. and they're specific. That way they can say, okay, well, we know on the seventh ship that comes through, this is the one we want to try to take out. So mm-hmm. As it goes through, it'll go boom and take the ship. But with our minesweeping equipment, we can go in and destroy those mines before that happens.
One of the things you were involved in, which really had international impact, was the attempted rescue of the Iranian hostages.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that. Now, I remember that President Carter was being very much frustrated by the Iranians, mm-hmm. for those of our listeners who are, you know, probably most people were not alive during then, or a lot of our audience may have been alive and don't remember the details. Give us a little recap of that.
Sitting back in Norfolk,
uh-huh.
just all of a sudden one afternoon, here we are, I'm ready to go on leave for Thanksgiving, and the squadron gets a phone call saying, hey, guess what, we got a mission for you and you're going to go do it. It basically silenced us. We weren't allowed to call anybody or tell anybody, or, you know.
Not even your family.
Not even our family. So it was like, okay, you go home at 5 o'clock and you'll be back at 5:30 in the morning with your bags packed ready to go. Those of us that trained to get the hostages out, that's exactly what happened to us. The rest of the squadron would be tearing down aircraft, putting them on C-5s,
mm-hmm. Air Force C-5s, large
yep.
cargo plane.
Yep, and we could put two on the C-5 and then fly them over and get them off and then build them back up and then fly them on board ships.
And what size were these aircraft if only two filled up the C-5?
When they're totally open, you know, rotor blades extended and everything, they're about 89 feet.
Mm-hmm.
That's the RH. Now, since then, they've come out with what they call the MH, which is a multi-mission helicopter, and it's bigger.
MH-53.
Yeah, MH-53E, and it's bigger by about 10 feet.
And that's the second largest helicopter there is.
I think the RH was the second largest. The largest is the MH-53.
Okay.
You know, it'll pick up to 32,000 pounds and heavy lift, such as that.
So continue the story. You guys go
okay,
and practice
so we got,
somewhere
first
in North
off,
Carolina?
Yeah, we were sent down to a place in North Carolina, and that's where we initially started our training. And it was unusual because it was the first time that I'd ever been in what they call a blue-green Navy Marine Corps mix. Nice. We had pilots and air crew that were enlisted and officer that were from both services. We trained there initially, and then about 3 weeks later, they said, well, we probably need to put you out in the desert, which is what we're going to be training to fly into.
Mm-hmm.
They sent us what they call Army Yuma Proving Grounds, okay, and Chocolate Mountains, all, you know, right out in that area. That's where we did the rest of our training, was out there, and we'd fly every night. We'd work on the helicopters all day long, and then we'd fly missions at night, training like we were going to rescue the hostages.
And how many hostages were there?
There were 44, I believe.
So that was a pretty audacious thing to think that we could go in and get them.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what you... I guess all that's declassified now.
It is declassified, but I'm going to tell you that the data that they were showing us was, you know, I'm going, wow. You know, back then, and that was 1979, 1980, I'm seeing photographs of vehicles where you can read your license plates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's how good the satellite imagery was back then. So can you imagine how good it is today?
Yeah. Now, that capability, I think, was classified at the time.
It was at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I went from just a secret clearance to a way up, you know, almost like
top secret.
Top secret plus, yes. Mm-hmm.
I know that you ended up with a medical situation where you didn't go to Iraq.
That is correct.
Tell us what they planned on doing and then what actually happened. Because what they planned on doing was pretty tough. It was
pretty tough.
Into the soccer field there.
You know, into Iran. You had to fly through the mountains. They had determined on where there was an area that they would not be seen. Their radars couldn't pick up the aircraft and flying in. So as they flew in, they ran into what they call a haboob, which is a huge sandstorm.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we were training. We weren't training because of the haboobs, but that's what happened when they went to go in.
Mm-hmm.
One of the aircraft had to turn around because they had some gyro problems, and trying to fly a helicopter that has gyro problems into a sandstorm, they couldn't do it, so they had to turn around and go back to the ship. So by the time they got to Desert One, they did not have the amount of... and then they had one aircraft that ended up going down because of rotor blade problems.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to have a minimum of 7 aircraft to fly out of Desert One, which is where they refueled and where all the problems happened, and they ended up flying a 53 into a C-130 because of the sand. The 53 didn't fly, just, you know, intentionally fly or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the sand was coming up, and they couldn't see.
Couldn't see.
And the guy that was directing the move, he was getting sandblasted, and he started moving, and when he moved, the helicopter thought they were moving, so they'd recorrected.
Oh.
And when they recorrected, they flew over top of the C-130, and they have external aux tanks, 50 gallons of fuel.
Auxiliary.
And that fuel just spilled out all over the C-130, and then it ignited, and then the helicopter crashed, and it caught on fire. The two pilots were able to get out, but they got out with severe burns. The crewmen, 3 crewmen that were on board, died in the melee of that aircraft going down.
Mm-hmm. They didn't have the special equipment on the aircraft that we have now. They didn't have GPS, and they didn't have a lot of things.
Yes, true.
And I know from my experience from the Air Force side of it, this is what led to the creation of the Special Ops Command.
Yes.
Involving all the services.
Yep. We were basically the first Special Ops when it came down to it, as far as helicopters, and then the Army took over a lot of that responsibility, and also the Air Force with their PAVLOs.
Mm-hmm. And when you say Desert One, that was the meeting point.
That was
the first
meeting point where Delta Force and was to be picked up and flown to Desert Two, where the mission would from there go on. Desert 2 was where we dropped off, where we would have dropped off Delta Force.
Mm-hmm.
And Delta Force would have gotten in trucks and gone into the city, and then they would have been right outside of the embassy there. And then at a pre-described time, they were going to go in, take out the bad guys,
mm-hmm.
and get the hostages, blow out the back wall. And there's a soccer stadium.
The back wall of the embassy.
The helicopters were going to land two at a time in the soccer field, and we were just going to put all the...
Through that wall, they would go into the
soccer stadium, and then we would just land, you know, end up stuffing all the hostages into aircraft, and then out, and then more aircraft would come in to pick up Delta Force and so on, and then we were going to go to Tehran Airport.
And do you think it would have worked?
I believe it would have worked.
Yeah, it was a pretty audacious plan. A lot of work went into it. But then when the aircraft crashed in the desert at the point known as Desert One, the mission was doomed at that point, right?
At that point, yeah, it was done. I think they had made a decision before that it was doomed because they didn't have all the aircraft they wanted. They only had six, and to fly another many hours to Desert Two, they wanted to make sure they had at least six airplanes at Desert Two, and they wouldn't have necessarily had that if something would have happened to, you know, any of the other aircraft. So that's when they were going to go ahead and pull out. So the air helicopters were refueling to be able to fly back to the ship, and they were, I guess, wait for another day. But, you know, of course, they ran into some problems with fuel trucks. They had to blow up, and then they had to stop a bus full of people.
Now, you say fuel trucks. It was just an Iranian truck
it was
that
an
happened
Iranian,
by.
Yeah, that just happened by. And
they blew it up so that they couldn't report back.
Yeah, it had to be blown up. Yeah. So they were pretty sure that it was hijacked.
Uh-huh.
And so they, of course, they torched it or trashed it. Then they had a bus of Iranians.
You weren't hurting them. You were just keeping them from being able to tell anybody.
That's correct. But then once the helicopter and the C-130 went up and, you know, burned, then they let all those people go.
Bill, we have about a minute left. Tell us some more stories about going to jump school, Fort Benning.
Wow. That was definitely something that was fun, and it wasn't fun, because I went in August.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was fun
probably,
when it was over, right?
Yeah, it was definitely fun when it was over. You know, you get there, and you have to run everywhere you go.
Mm-hmm.
The first time, you know, they hang you up in what they call harnesses, you know, and the kind of harness that you're going to have when you jump out, and you just have to hang there for however long. And then, of course, the first jump we ever made was actually from the tower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's at 250 feet. Your parachute course is already deployed, so they just cut you loose, and, you know, you come down. Then eventually you start making your jumps. And, of course, my first jump was out of a C-119 boxcar.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't real happy with that. But after that, then we jumped out of C-130s and C-141s, and I have made some helicopter blasts, which was fun.
Bill, thanks so much for taking time to talk to our audience at the Triangle Radio Reading Service. We appreciate it very much.
Well, I appreciate you having me.
Well, that wraps up our time for this week's edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after this broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Salute a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or in discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh. Or call 919-917-7729. For more information, visit them at www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out.